Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out for our last Thursday morning roundtable before we go on hiatus for a bit. We're very pleased to have with us this morning Brian Conkle, who is the first, or the seventh, Hendricks Chapel Dean, and he was appointed in April. Reverend Conkle is an ordained minister of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, with a diverse and global background of service, ministry, and teaching. Prior to his appointment at Gustavus Adolphus College, he served as co-pastor of Lake Edge Lutheran Church in Madison, Wisconsin. From 2008 to 2012, he served in South Africa as country coordinator of the Young Adults in Global Mission Program of the ELCA. He also assisted in parish ministry along isiZulu speaking congregations of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Southern Africa. From 2003 to 2007, Reverend Conkle interned with and later served a parish with Evangelical Lutheran Church in Guyana, where he also lectured at the Lutheran Lay Academy and co-hosted the nationally televised broadcast Word for the World. Reverend Conkle is originally from Amherst Junction, Wisconsin. He earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Criminal Justice from Viterbo University, a Master of Divinity degree from Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, and a Master of Theology and a Doctor of Philosophy degrees in the School of Religion, Philosophy, and Classics at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. Beth Broadway started as a consultant at Interfaith Works in 1976, helping to found the agency's community-wide Dialogue to End Racism program. After serving as the director of the program, she was appointed president and CEO of Interfaith Works in 2010. Beth manages a $2.5 million agency of 32 employees with the vision of building cross-culture bridges of understanding between the many ethnic, religious, and socioeconomic groups in Central New York. She received a bachelor's degree in social work from Southern Illinois University Carbondale and a master's of science degree in leadership educational policy studies from Northern Illinois University. Please join me in welcoming today's guests.
Hello, everyone. So great that you could make it out. We're glad it wasn't yesterday with all of the great snow that we had, and we're glad to be here together. Brian and I have begun to speak with each other and get to know each other and have already worked on a couple of projects together, one of which was to bring a group of brand new American pastors to Hendricks Chapel for a day of reflection on what it's like to pastor as a new person in Syracuse. So it's a great pleasure to work with Brian, and I know he's going to be a huge asset to our Syracuse community. We're asked to speak today on the topic of interfaith cooperation and conflict transformation, and so that's what we're going to do right now. So we wanted to get started by just talking a little bit about what does interfaith cooperation really mean, and a little bit more also then about the context for the current conflict as it relates to our inability to have interfaith cooperation globally and often sometimes here right in the United States. And so Brian and I are going to speak to those issues, and then what does it take to transform our conflicts into a place of understanding democracy and common ground. So that's really what we have planned for this morning, and by the end of this hour we will have peace on earth. There we go. So I wanted to just say a little bit about interfaith cooperation and what does it really mean. Our agency, Interfaith Works, was founded in 1976. I was not here in 1976 to help found that, but was in 1996 where we founded the Dialogue Center. at Interfaith Works. What we did, though, in 1976 is we built upon an interfaith effort that had happened in the civil rights movement in this country. So I have a picture for you that many of you will recognize. This was a picture, and as you look across the crowd in this picture, it's a picture of Dr. Martin Luther King leading the march in Selma. And you can see people of all different faiths in the crowd. You can see standing very close to him, a rabbi. You can see in the crowd people who are wearing an Islamic kufi on their head. Many, many Christian leaders are there. There are some Catholic leaders there. And it was really in that time, and probably the real start of the modern movement of interfaith cooperation as we know it today, was during that civil rights movement, when faith leaders and civic leaders came together around the justice and rights for all human beings. And it's really that movement that founded what our organization is here in Central New York, Interfaith Works. Many of you may know it formerly as the Syracuse Area Interreligious Council, or the Interreligious Council, and about 10 years ago we changed our name to Interfaith Works. Now, that work really brought together people from all different faith traditions and all across the community to address the needs of all people and to find common ground where every human was given the opportunity to achieve their potential. And since that time in 1976, when those faith leaders wanted to continue the work that had occurred during the 50s and 60s, we established something called the Roundtable of Faith Leaders at Interfaith Works. This was a group of faith. Now, go back to 1976 with me for a minute. It was radical to have Protestants and Catholics talking to one another in this country, right? My mother is a Lutheran, and she's strongly, Lutheran, and she was not ready to have conversations with Catholics until the Lutheran Church women said, "Let's go meet the Catholic women." This was radical activity, let alone now we're going to meet Jewish women, and now we're going to be working together on these critical issues. And of course, today, the interfaith movement is so much broader than that, even with people who are Baha'i, people who are from various Muslim sects, people who are from the Latter-day Saints, several Buddhist groups. So the Roundtable of Faith Leaders today here in Syracuse meets every month, and they've been meeting every month for 41 years. And they get together to build a relationship with one another and to find the common ground that lives at the core of all the ethical traditions that we see across the planet. Now think of that. For all those years, people have been coming together, learning about each other, learning to respect each other. And that's been happening right here in our community for all of that time. And very recently, we put in a beautiful set of Stickley cabinets as you enter into our building at 1010 James, where the sacred texts of each of those traditions live together in this lighted cabinet. You're welcome to come and reflect on that and to see how all of these texts that guide our faith traditions are together in one place. I don't think you see that very often. So Syracuse has a great history of interfaith cooperation and interfaith understanding. I wanted to show you a picture. The next picture that you see here is a slide of an interfaith event that took place right after the earthquakes in Nepal, which were so devastating. And we were asked by the Bhutanese and Nepalese communities, the Hindu communities, to come together. And so many faith leaders came together, and you see in this slide the beginnings of that prayer service, which took place in one of the parks here, where we actually made the shape of Nepal with flour and lit candles all around it and thinking about and praying for the people in Nepal. So in our next slide, you have a quote, which I thought was very important. It's from an interfaith leader in the United States, Diana Eck. And she says, "Interfaith understanding, interfaith cooperation is really the energetic engagement of diversity towards a positive end." And that's really what the Roundtable of Faith Leaders has been doing and what Interfaith Works has been doing. And I think there are three principles that we all agree are at the core of what it means to build interfaith understanding and interfaith cooperation. The first one is respect for each person's identities. Now, what we mean by that is not that when you get together that you become mush, you know, that you become one thing, but rather that the identities of each of those faith traditions, of the cultures from which they come, are respected, are thought highly of, we become curious about each other, we want to know more about each other, not so much because we want to become each other, but because we want to work together with one another, with that great diversity of people. The second thing you see on this slide is the mutually inspiring relationships. So through that agreement to come together and to sit together and to learn about one another and to respect the differences among ourselves, we end up having relationships that are inspiring. We end up learning and deepening. It's this paradox. We deepen our own faith traditions by learning about each other's faith traditions. And then thirdly, to commit to the common good. That lying underneath all of what happens in that roundtable and in all of interfaith's work is a commitment to finding what is best for all of us. And how do we get there? And we get there through accepting and respecting each other. We get there through understanding that our relationships bring us to a place of willingness to find common ground and then to take action, as we did with the Nepal earthquake, raising money for that, giving people a place to come together to grieve, to feel the support of the entire community, not just their own community, but all communities, and to work on activities together. One of the things that the roundtable was able to do immediately after the Twin Towers were flown into and this act of violence towards our country occurred was that they didn't have to build their relationship on the spot. They already had each other. They had already been to each other's places of worship. They had already met and had lunch at Panera as faith leaders. They had already had an opportunity to build relationships so that when this terrible act happened, they could come together quickly and they could be a resource to our community. So the interfaith understanding has to be built over time. The relationships have to be sustained over time. And there has to continually be conversation to find that common good. In the next slide, we've kind of got a little picture. There's a wonderful national organization called the Interfaith Youth Corps, and it's meeting on campuses all across the United States to build bridges of understanding between young people who are of different faiths. Part of the theory there is that the younger we can get to have these positive and thoughtful relationships with one another, whether those differences are faith-based, culturally based, ethnically based, color of our skin based, that when we have those early and positive relationships, we carry that through for the remainder of our life. And so I know Brian's going to talk about some of the things that go on campuses in order to promote that, because that's really at the core of Hendricks Chapel as well. But you see a triangle here that really just restates some of the things that I've been saying to you, that the relationships really filter and help people to build positive attitudes towards one another. And the relationships increase our knowledge about each other. And it goes the other way as well. When we have good knowledge about each other, we can build good relationships about each other. Now, one of the things that we've been doing of late here is developing some programs to do that in our community so that people, in particular, because our agency is a resettlement agency, and we resettled last year over 600 refugees. This year we might settle 100 refugees. But we find that people don't understand who refugees are. There's a lot of rhetoric right now in our country that would have us be afraid of refugees, that would see refugees as other, as people who should not be welcomed into our community. And nothing is further from the truth. In 35 years of settling refugees, we have come to meet some of the most remarkable people on the planet, people who have survived the worst things, have run from the worst things that the humans can do to one another, and have come to make life good for themselves, but especially for their children and future generations. And so what we try to do is to get out through a program called Spirit of America into the faith communities, into book clubs, into the library groups, wherever we can have a refugee come and talk about their story and their experience. And we have been to 47 places in the since July 4th when we kicked off Spirit of America Project. And we've met with over 3,000 people throughout Central New York so that refugees can tell their real story. And they can talk about how carefully they are vetted. They can talk about why they left their countries, what it meant to them to leave their countries, what kind of faith they have, so that people can understand a little more about each other's faiths. And I can tell you that the heart of Americans opens when they have this experience. The heart of Americans is a compassionate and loving heart. And we've seen this happen over and over and over again. So this statement here, the goal of interfaith leadership is to bring people together, to build relationships, to learn about each other, and to participate in common action despite political, theological, and spiritual differences is at the core of what we mean by interfaith cooperation. It's at the core of it. It does not mean, again, that we all become the same person. In fact, we really want to know about each other's different politics, theologies, and spiritual differences. So we've been doing that work, as I said, through Spirit of America, through the Roundtable. Annually, we participate with the United Nations in something called the World Interfaith Harmony Assembly, which was asked for by the King of Jordan as he observed about 10 years ago that many of the world conflicts are based in misunderstandings among people of different faiths, and that to come together and to share a little bit about our faiths and to have a place where people are respectfully listened to is something that he was asking the whole world to do in our communities. And we picked up on it right away, and we'll be celebrating our 7th World Interfaith Harmony on February 5th. And this year it's going to be real harmony, because each of the faith traditions are going to be sharing a little bit about how they worship, how they speak to the world through song. So it'll be a wonderful event, and we hope people will watch for that and come to that. We also have something called dinner dialogues, where across the community, 20 to 25 people decide to host a vegetarian meal, and they open their home to strangers that we find and put together in a very diverse group of people who can come together at the home of this host with a facilitator and have an evening where they learn about each other's faiths, learn what people believe, learn what people don't believe, and have a conversation with one another that they would not normally or typically have on their own weekend events. And we also have ending racism dialogues and interfaith dialogues with the express intent of building bridges of understanding so that people can work together to solve the larger problems like poverty that we have here in our community. And we see people, again, getting into the dialogues, thinking, oh, is this going to go anywhere? And the heart opens, the mind opens, the desire to have a diverse life opens. And it's been an incredible experience for people who've been part of these dialogues. So I want you to, here's a little test for you. I want you to guess which president said this. On the screen it says, "We cannot carry the message of freedom and the baggage of bigotry at the same time." And this was held at an iftar dinner at the White House. And an iftar dinner is a breaking of the fast during the 30 days of Ramadan, which is a very holy time for Muslims around the world. And so the White House decided to hold an iftar dinner. And this was the message from the president. Again, we cannot carry the message of freedom and the baggage of bigotry at the same time. Who, guess who that was? It was not Donald Trump. Donald Trump, as I don't think he held an iftar dinner at the White House. We can look that up. Okay, anybody else have another guess? It was George W. Bush. Thank you, Stan. Yes, it was George W. Bush who held an iftar dinner, and many, many presidents have held iftar dinners, as well as other kinds of events that have honored various faith traditions. And so I guess I had a question for you at this point in the presentation. Of what agenda does conflict serve? What agenda does conflict serve? Because what we have discovered in all of these many, many decades of doing interfaith work and building interfaith cooperation is that people are deeply enriched by this work and grow in ways that change the brain and change the heart and change the intent of our community. So what would it serve us to have conflict? Well, I have a little picture for you. And here's a picture of some folks on a boat in London when Brexit came out. And Brexit, of course, stood for the British exit out of the European Union. And as the more I read about Brexit and what has happened in our own country with the ascendancy of the Trump administration, is I recognize, as you most likely do, that there is a conflict to be served by creating interfaith conflict, and that is that there's an isolationism and a creation of fear of the other that occurs when we want to promote interfaith conflict. I was just with a young woman whose family I'm just emotional about it, but she and her family are refugees from Armenia, and they were part of the refugee exodus about 20 years ago out of Armenia. And the family had lived in the section of Azerbaijan where most Armenians lived. And of course, part of the Armenian problem there was about land and who owned the land. Was it Azerbaijan's land or Armenia's land, and et cetera? And when they were forced to flee because neighbor turned against neighbor, it was about economics and it was about land. But it came to be about, we don't want the Armenian Christians in our Muslim land. And then when they got to Armenia, the Armenians didn't want them because they had been Azerbaijani. And so we create this kind of conflict around economics, in tight economic times, which we are in many, many quarters of this nation. We have to have scapegoats. We have to have people that we can turn to and say, this is what the problem is. We know this from what happened in Europe leading up to the Second World War. The conflict was served by targeting Jews. We see a similar sort of activity going on in our world right now. And so this picture of the Brexit boats and people supporting that is an example of that. And I have a much too full slide that really talks about some of the ascendancy of this anti-Muslim speech. And there are numbers and numbers of websites that lay out the ascendancy of the current administration's negativity towards Muslims that is important for us to read and to know about. And so what I would suggest to you is that the conflict that is being served right now is to distract us from really getting to the common ground of what we need to do about the economic crisis for so many people, and turning that instead towards being afraid of and building fear in our country towards people who are of Muslim tradition, people who are of darker skin color, and people who are considered to be the other. And that this is a very dangerous thing for us to do as a country, a very, very dangerous thing. One of the final statements that was on this slide here, as you can say, is that And as you can see, some of the hatred and the vitriolic language directed at Muslims ends in a statement that says we have a major, major problem. This is a war. This was the statement that was made by our president. And so a question that I have always found quite compelling is that truth is the first casualty of war. So if we are in a war against Muslim people, the truth about Muslim people can only be found by having relationships in our community with Muslim people, by learning about their faith, by going to the mosque, and we are very welcome there as Christians, as Jews, as Buddhists, as Sikhs. We are welcome in each other's places of worship. I have never found a more welcoming community in terms of interfaith cooperation and understanding. Because what you will find there is that you will find truth in the compassionate souls of all of these faith traditions and the compassionate service and the desire to serve. So I want to turn it over to Brian at this point for a little bit more looking at conflict transformation.
Good morning, everyone. Good to see you here. People always ask, how are you doing with the weather? I moved here from Minnesota. So I'm doing quite fine. I moved here in mid-July, and on one of my very first days at Hendricks Chapel, I went on a walk. Went out the front doors of Hendricks Chapel and started going down the street, and about two blocks down, I encounter our Jewish rabbi who works at Hendricks Chapel and also works at Hillel a couple blocks away, and we start walking together. And as we're talking, we all of a sudden encounter the Muslim chaplain at Syracuse University. And so all of a sudden, within about 3 minutes, the three of us are walking down the sidewalk together, a Lutheran pastor, a Jewish rabbi, and a Muslim imam. And as we all know, this, of course, is the beginning of every bad barroom joke you've ever heard. I wasn't around here long enough. I looked at them. I said, we gotta find a bar. We got to go in right now. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. People would have thought we had a serious problem if we had done so. But as we were walking together, it was indicative of, I think, of what happens at Hendricks Chapel. I think it's indicative of some of the things that Beth was speaking about a moment ago. It's indicative of a methodology of interfaith engagement and what I would call conflict transformation. The idea of accompaniment. We accompany one another through our distinctiveness, through our differences, not trying to be the same, as Beth mentioned a moment ago, but being committed to journeying together, knowing that all three of us have deep, significant theological differences, right? We do. And to say we don't is a disrespect to the two of them and to me as well. But we continue to journey together. So, part of interfaith engagement for me in conflict transformation is the recognition that when we build bridges to the other, whoever the other might be, or when we open ourselves up to allow the other to build a bridge to us, we recognize that the bridge usually is not built from the water up. The bridge is usually built from one piece of solid ground to the other. At least that's how it starts. So for me, when I think about growing up in a Lutheran church, growing up in central Wisconsin, I think about what are the particular resources from my own theological tradition that serve as the groundwork to build that bridge to others and to allow others to build that bridge to myself. So the Imago Dei. Beth, a moment ago, talked about identity. And from the tradition in which I come, I think about the sense of the Imago Dei in that each and every person we encounter is created in the image and likeness of God. Created in the image and likeness of God. It makes an assertion. It makes an assertion that every single person has value simply for the reality of being. You have value because you are. Full stop. In the Christian tradition, we know that this comes from the book of Genesis. We're thinking about the creation story and that each and every person has dignity and, dare we might say, divinity. which leads us to a mathematical equation, meaning that just because something is different does not necessarily mean it is deficient. That if you are created in God's likeness and image, and if I'm created in God's likeness and image, just because you're different doesn't mean you're deficient. Which leads me to one of my favorite quotations. Wade Davis is a Canadian anthropologist. He writes, "The world in which you were born is just one model of reality. Other cultures are not failed attempts at being you. They are unique manifestations of the human spirit." So I grew up in a town of about 250 people. Diversity in Amherst Junction, Wisconsin, tended to be the left-handers and the right-handers. You know, so I was a left-hander, and truly, my mother, recognizing my marginalized population, bought me like books as a child of famous left-handed people, which is no short list, by the way. You know, so for me, it's the reality in which I was born. A Lutheran church where worship was 58 and a half minutes long. And all of a sudden, I found myself living in Guyana and living in South Africa, where worship is 4.5 hours long, where the offering is 45 minutes long, and people dance, and it actually looks okay. And all of a sudden, you're living in communities where a third of the population is Muslim and a third of the population is Hindu, where you have a neighbor who's Rastafarian, another neighbor who's Baha'i, another neighbor who's Baha'i, Rastafarian, Jewish, Muslim, and Lutheran on Tuesdays. You know, it's, you recognize that just because something is different doesn't necessarily mean it's deficient. Why? Because from my view, we're all created in the image and likeness of God, and that identity matters, and we can value it. Which pushes us into the second theological resource, what I want to bring about, is called koinonia. Falls into what Beth was talking about relationships. Relationships. Koinonia comes from the Greek word about communion by intimate participation. And when I say communion, I'm not thinking about a sacramental reality as we think about the bread and the wine that is served on Sunday mornings. Communion of the sense of community, the sense of togetherness, that we're all in this together. And we see examples of this in the New Testament in Acts chapter 2, when people are sharing together, when they're belonging to one another. I think it's this incredible resource that reminds us that we need each other to become ourselves. Community. So that when we're talking about being created in God's image, recognizing that we were created for the sake of community. We were created to be together. To belong to one another. People often ask me about some of the transition after living overseas for 10 years and coming back to the United States. What are some of the things that you face and some of the struggles comparative-wise? And for me, it does come back to this sense of koinonia, because it's recognition that when we're talking about interfaith engagement and conflict transformation, it's starting from the philosophical tradition that guides many of our lives. And it begins with Cogito Ergo Sum, by from René Descartes, "I think, therefore, I am." Many of you know that statement. Many, I think, persuasively make the case that this, in many ways, is the birthplace for what we would call rugged individualism in North America. This belief that you and I were all born in log cabins that we built ourselves, right? And our language gives it away. Open up your dictionaries and find how many words have the prefix self in front of them, right? And we could go around the room right now and talk about it. Self-confident, self-esteem, self-absorbed, self-whatever, right? There's many, 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 many words. Many languages in the Southern Hemisphere and out East do not have translations for those words, which tells us something, because it's a recognition that we can't really be self anything. In some shape or form, we're products of our environment, and our environments are products of us. In South Africa, there's a great counter to this, Ubuntu. Instead of saying, "I think, therefore, I am," Ubuntu says, "I am because we are." I am because we are. A really quick story. My son was born during our time in South Africa, and on the day that he was born, a group of men came to our community to inform me that my name had been changed. Not something that happens every day, right? I'm like, well, you know, well, what is it? That can go poorly, right? That can go poorly. Up to that point, my name in the community had been Umfundisi Konkolo, which kind of means Pastor Konkol. But after that, they said, your name now is Baba Kaya. Kaya's daddy. My son's name is Kaya. Because my relationships had changed, my very name had changed, my identity. That's powerful. Because I am because we are. And a person can only be a person through other people. And that draws us to one another. It draws us into one another, into the reality that if we're speaking about conflict, and we're talking about you and I not being able to live to our full capacity and authentic reality, I can't be all that I can be unless you are all that you can be, and vice versa. We need each other to become ourselves. And I think it begins with the recognition that a person is only a person through other people. And that's what Koinonia points us towards. Beth talked about the common good. I think it draws us into this reality about how do we do things for one another. This idea of stepping on each other's toes, pushing each other down to succeed. Conflict transformation, in my view, is a recognition that we're all in this together. We put our feet into the circle and we journey together. And this is our common cause. We talked about the Imago Dei at the beginning, in line with what Beth talked about identity. For me, when I think about the common good, I think about the Missio Dei, a theological term that talks that God is up to something. God is up to something, and you and I are invited to participate in it. So, of course, the question is what? And I would argue that it's a three-part harmony. From my theological tradition, and I think about what God is up to, I think the act of reconciliation, transformation, and empowerment, about building bridges, about transforming the structures and systems that create conflict in the first place, and about inspiring one another, animate one another, so that we are empowered to use our gifts for the fullest. And I think that this is what draws us into conflict transformation. For those looking for a full definition of what this is about, conflict transformation is this belief that conflict is never resolved. That's the first thing. We talk often about conflict resolution. I believe that that's a myth, actually. Conflict has an energy to it, right? You all know the last time. You just had Thanksgiving when the in-laws came over. There's an energy with conflict, right? It sits in your heart. Sometimes physically you're shaking. I don't think that ever gets resolved. I think it just goes somewhere else. So the question becomes, how do we actually transform conflict instead of an energy source that pushes us apart or pushes one down, but how does it draw us together so we can get on that sidewalk and keep walking together? And it's a holistic experience. This comes from John Paul Lederach, a Mennonite who's done work at Notre Dame and also Eastern Mennonite University. I'll go through these quickly. When I think about the body of conflict transformation, we think about our head, our heart, our hands, and our legs because it's a holistic experience. We're talking about attitudes, perceptions, and orientation. How do we see one another? What are the assumptions that we make about one another when we encounter someone, especially someone who may be different from ourselves? We're thinking about the heart, a starting point, an ending point, human relationships, and life-giving opportunities. Bringing our heart to transform conflict. Our hands, putting it into practice. One of the biggest and I think most valid criticisms of those in my work surrounding religious and spiritual life is sometimes we're so heavenly minded we do no earthly good. theological affirmations at their very core are meant to have social and political implications. So if I believe that you are created in the image and likeness of God, then I need to ensure that our public policies are shaped in a way that live that out. That live that out. Our theological affirmations are meant to have public, social, political implications. So it's about taking it from our head and our heart into our hands and into our legs. And this is what we're talking about, peace, the goal of conflict transformation. There's negative peace and there's positive peace. Negative peace is simply the cessation of violence. Positive peace is creating the structures and systems necessary to prevent violence from happening once again. So I think that this is what it draws us to. When people talk about religious and spiritual communities, oftentimes people talk about conversion. And sometimes people think that this is what interfaith engagement is about, truly. Think, well, I am going to engage with people of different traditions so that I convert them to my tradition, right? I want to push back against that a little bit. I think that there is actually a conversion that takes place in interfaith engagement. And there's a conversion that takes place in conflict transformation. The very word conversion means a radical reorientation. So actually, I hope that students of Syracuse University and others are converted every day. I hope that citizens are converted every day and have their orientation radically reorientated to think things differently, to evolve. When we think of conversion, oftentimes we think of the individual, of me being converted to your perspective or you being converted to my perspective. But conflict transformation recognizes that if we're looking at a communal understanding of life, that conversion is about how do we convert our connections? How do we convert our connections so that no longer is our society shaped like this, but we can actually encounter this? Conflict transformation recognizes that you and I are connected at all times, all the ways, every day, no matter what. It's not a choice you and I make. We're always connected. And we're connected with each and every living human being around the world. We're connected with the earth. It's not a choice we make. The choice we make is how do we wish to be connected? If you punch me in the face, we're connected. I do not appreciate the nature of that connection, right? At each and every day, that is the nature of some of our connections around the society, both locally and globally. So how do we convert our connections from violence and exploitation into connections of embrace and encounter? So briefly, this is what we're doing at Hendricks Chapel. Hendricks Chapel is a place at the heart of Syracuse University where we get on that sidewalk and we journey together. It takes education of the whole person seriously. Hendricks Chapel, I think, has three amazing things going for it right now, and I'll say this briefly. The first thing is that Hendricks Chapel has a remarkable history. To think that a group of Methodists in the 1920s came together and built an interfaith chapel is quite frankly quite extraordinary. That in its very DNA, people built a place for all people and a home for all faiths at the center of Syracuse University. I find that extraordinary. It's extraordinary in 2017. I can only imagine in the 1920s. The pushback that they must have received, right? It has tremendous history. The second thing that Hendricks Chapel has going for it right now is the support of a diverse and vibrant community. Every single year, about 125,000 people walk through the doors of Hendricks Chapel, from music to lectures to worshiping communities to the coffee shop downstairs to hang out, to study. It's an incredibly visible and vibrant place where people gather together to find common ground for the sake of the common good. And everywhere I go already, traveling around this country, when I talk to people in the Syracuse University community, everyone has a story about Hendricks Chapel. It's a beloved place. It's a supported place. It has history. It has community. And the third thing is it has an opportunity. Right now, as students are yearning for a sense of purpose and meaning and direction in their lives, right now, as students are looking for communities to belong to, recognizing that in order to belong, they become, and in order to become, you belong. There's an opportunity right now for Hendricks to simply grow, expand, deepen, widen, and we're really excited. And so when I think about the history, the community, and the opportunity, I'm reminded of the giftedness that we have in front of us. Because it is about those students. Chancellor Severud might be my boss, but I work for those students. And when I think about what they need and what they want, Hendricks Chapel is a wonderful place for that. Because we are a home for all faiths and a place for all people. Were we able to engage in the great work that Beth and others have been engaging in this community and transforming the conflicts of our society, because there's no shortage of them. So that it's not just about what they learn at their time, but it's also who they become. So that when these students encounter Hendricks Chapel and they graduate from Syracuse University, they receive far more than a stepping stone to an entry-level job. But they receive a launching pad to an extraordinary life. A life where they're able to encounter difference, transform conflict, and find the common good. I think we'll take your questions.
Hi, thanks for your great messages, and you've given me things to think about, conflict and community. And my question is about a certain kind of passivity or a kind of a we're there, we're doing things. You know, today, I think more than ever, your messages are necessary, and even people of good intention seem to be overwhelmed, and so your messages are important for them. But we've got this gale going on, this kind of hurricane of divisiveness and polarization, and what I'm wondering is there a way to be more... What is the most muscular work you are doing to kind of break through, to kind of be heard over the gale force of people? You know, more than 500,000 people voted for that guy in Alabama. And people are blowing themselves up just to kill other people. And you know, we've got a terrible situation here, and somehow we have to do more, like Martin Luther King, to get people's attention.
Yeah, it can give you despair, can't it? The gale. To answer the question in there, what is the big thing that you do is actually a small thing that we have to do. You know, I have a number of heroes, people who have guided my work over these many years, including Dr. King, and also a man named Miles Horton, and he wrote a book called The Long Haul. And Miles was the founder of the Highlander Folk Schools, where many of the civil rights leaders received their training. And Miles said, we are in this work for the long haul, and that the work of building a community where, to use Brian's term, Ubuntu, in other words, that I am human because we are human, is the long haul work that we have to do. So I would say for Interfaith Works, one of the biggest things that we do in this gale force is to continuously work on breaking down stereotypes. Because when we don't carry the stereotypes about each other, we have the opportunity to actually see the humanness of each other. And so helping people to have experiences where they learn to put aside the stereotypes that we get because we live segregated and separated from each other, and having a place where we can come together and not be segregated and separated from each other gives us the strength to want that, to yearn for that, to desire to have the whole human family as a part of our family. And I think that's one of the most important things that we can do. And so for us, each of us, to put ourselves in places where our own comforts are challenged, to put ourselves out in places where we're meeting with and working with people who are different from ourselves, and to be doing work that brings us together around common projects, common activities, is the antidote, is the aspirin against that despair.
I think saying what is the most muscular thing, I think the most radical thing that any of us can do in these times is to listen. And to listen to others with the intent to understand rather than with the intent to respond. So when I think about my own prayer life, when I think about my relationships, I do so recognizing that how tempting it can be to only listen with the intent to respond, and that I'm not really listening, but I'm just kind of gathering my ammunition for my response, you know? How tempting that is. In this country, we talk about the freedom of speech, but rarely do we talk about the responsibility to listen. And we have countless courses, and Syracuse University is one of them, where we talk about people really need to learn the art of public speaking. Why don't we teach the art of public listening? Right now, this traditional-aged university students have an attention span that's under 8 seconds. And for those of you in this room that are not of traditional college age, you're not much better. a goldfish is about 9 seconds. True. So paying attention to one another, to me, is actually foundational in the spiritual life. Much of spiritual practice and spiritual discipline is about paying attention. And so when I think about elections that don't go the way that I think they should go, or when I see people acting the way that I don't think they should act, I think part of it is to try to understand. And I think that that's a first bridge. And I find I'm less likely to demonize someone when they're a someone and not just those people. And I think listening is the most radical act that we can do to break through that.
Hi, I'm Dee Cleese. I'm Communications Director for Focus Greater Syracuse, and we bring together people to discuss things. So I have a short answer question and a longer answer question. My short answer question is, I'm wondering, what's the geographical breadth that Interfaith Works covers? And the longer answer question relates to your mention of bringing in the new ministers in the area to work together, and how you contacted them, and whether there are parts of the community that you would like to still draw in to work with Interfaith Works and with the chapel. Those are my questions.
Our service area is central New York, so that covers we are primarily located here in Onondaga County, but we do work in Madison County and in Cayuga County and up in Oswego. And then to your question around how did we find the new American pastors, because we're a refugee serving agency, we meet them when they first arrive, and have been a place for them to come and work with a case manager to get their lives started. And so we've been accompanying them, you know, since they first got off the airplane. And that's how we've gotten to know them. And then one pastor knows another pastor who knows another pastor who knows another pastor. And that's how the pastors came together. This particular group of pastors were all from various parts of Africa, and they were all Christian pastors. And so this was a very decidedly Christian group of people. But there are faith leaders here from all different traditions. And so right now at the round table, we have people from two different Buddhist religions. We have people at the table from a Sikh community that came as immigrants some time ago. And so we want to be continuing to reach out to the Corinne community, which has got several different faith traditions within it. There's a Christian Corinne church that's just taken over the VFW hall, so I've got to go down there and knock on the door and say hello. There are many different Hindu groups that are growing up now because of the incoming people from Nepal and from Bhutan. Now, no English-speaking Hindu leader just yet, so we've got to figure out how to now start doing translation at the roundtable so that people can be welcome. So those are just some of the groups that we're reaching out to.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. I'm Pam Brunet with Leadership Greater Syracuse. Do you know of any expert in this town that teaches the art of listening that I could bring into my class?
No. you know, that's a great question. But when you find her or him, please give him my number or her my number. You know, I think that there's something to be said about that, right? You know, and we talked about this. We have a conflict program at the Maxwell School at Syracuse, and it's something that I've been working on over there. And I think it's something that we need to be thinking about. Listening's hard. It's really hard. And perhaps other in this room have been a part of some of those retreats and exercises where you're learning the art of active listening. It's hard not to jump in. We did one just last night, the strategic planning process of Hendricks Chapel, and people were going around the room reflecting on the mission and values. And the rule was, of course, no interjection. I mean, I could just, you know, I talked about the energy of conflict. Oh my gosh. I was just sitting there like wanting to like to just jump in and jump in and jump in. And I was so thankful to be instructed to concentrate on listening. And I'm reminded of my grandmother who passed away about a year ago, who was 99 years old, and always had these wise things to say. And I remember her telling me that we have two ears and one mouth so that we could listen twice as much as we speak. Now, I failed at that, but I think there's something to be said about that. So let's find out. And if no one exists, then let's teach that class together.
One of the things I would encourage, Pam, is anybody to get involved in a dialogue, a community-wide dialogue. They're free. They do teach listening. We're doing police community dialogues right now in wake of what has happened to African-American men across our community and in meeting with the police chief saying, you know, how close are we to something happening here like what happened in Ferguson and what would impact that have and how can we have police officers and community members from our city communities meeting together and sitting together. Now talk about difficulty in listening to each other. But to create those kinds of, what I call, it's a sacred container. It's a sacred space where people can come together with a trained facilitator, create a set of ground rules for themselves as a group, and then to have the facilitator say, hold on a second now, we've agreed that we're going to listen to each other. We've agreed to respect each other's differences. We've agreed to listen even if we don't agree. And that's what we've got to really build back into our society is this opportunity for people to have these sacred or community spaces where we actually do have to listen to each other. It is a muscle that we have to develop. You know, it's like going to the gym. If you want to get biceps, they don't happen because you want it. They happen because you do it. And it's the same kind of a thing. And, you know, back to Fred's question around, you know, that you know, what's the muscle? I think we're developing a muscle that we saw in January in this community when the first executive order against immigrants and refugees happened. Right here in Syracuse, there were 1,000 people at the Syracuse airport. Now, what is it that has meant with this latest executive order that limits a larger number of people, a larger number of countries, that nobody's at the airport? Is it compassion fatigue? Is it that we haven't yet developed enough of that muscle? I mean, I think this is the time that we're in, and we've been doing a lot of advocacy work at Interfaith Works for refugees. And, you know, I look at my board, and gosh, they've got biceps now. they, you know, they are strong now. They're getting stronger, and that's what we've got to do, is develop that listening muscle, develop our ability to speak out, and to not allow our despair or whatever it is that keeps us from continuing to act on our compassionate heart.
Thank you for the presentation. David Reed. I'm a local attorney and a comebacker, as Chucky Holstein would say. I lived out of the area for 15 years, and when I returned, one of the things I was amazed at is, one, our lack of interaction with our Native brethren down on the Onondaga Nation. I haven't heard them mentioned as part of the conversation and dialogue that you have. But the second thing is, most of the negativity I've encountered is often from the individuals who've never lived outside of this area, and I just wonder if some of your dialogue conversations exist primarily because of others who have come to our area and wish to bring their energy and their views, or are you finding that homegrown individuals are also actively participating?
It's quite a mix, David. It's quite a mix. And there have been many, many Native people who have participated in the conversation. They don't have a representative at the roundtable. So, Frida, Oren, if you're listening, we would love to have you at the roundtable. We have people, many, many of the people that are participants in the dialogue, and over 15,000 people across Central New York in these 22 years of the Dialogue Center have been, you know, Native-born people. But also, you're right, this is a, you know, I was reading the newspaper yesterday, and it was there was a whole page on all of these new restaurants and stores that are, there's a Korean restaurant, there's a new Congolese restaurant, you know, on and on the list goes. So we are really quite an international city. I don't think we claim it yet, but we really are quite an international city. And what a gift that is to people who were born here, as well as people who've emigrated here from those Lutheran places like Minnesota and Chicago. Both of us, you know, to have such an international place to be together. So it gives us the opportunity to have very rich intercultural, interfaith dialogues.
I really appreciate the question. I had the honor of being at Chief Paulus's funeral, was that 2 weeks ago?
No.
And it was just a really wonderful experience, especially as someone so new to the community. I think when I spoke about accompaniment at the beginning, about journeying alongside each other on the sidewalk, I don't think it's limited to simply the specific lens of interfaith engagement. I also think that there can be a local global dynamic there too. Like, for example, in a couple days, we'll send students from Hendricks Chapel to Puerto Rico to assist in relief efforts. But we're going to do so not as saviors from the north, but as accompaniers, to go and accompany, recognizing that there's people there before we got there, and there will be people remaining there after those students leave. And when I think about our global engagement often, and of course recognizing myself as a Christian, thinking about foreign missionaries going to various countries to fix and change and what have you. Accompaniment can be a part of that as well. So for myself, being new to the Syracuse community, I think I have a responsibility first and foremost to be a lover of history and to understand that this stream has been flowing long before I stepped up in front of it. And so you have to question, where is it coming from, and what are the joys, the sorrows, the scars, and the celebrations of this particular section of the stream? But I also think that there is that opportunity for when someone like myself or the countless others who are new to any community, sometimes the newcomer can see that the picture frame is a little bit off. And sometimes when we see that over and over again, we get immune to it and we stop seeing it. And a fresh insertion of energy and perspective can help us to see things that we perhaps have allowed ourselves not to no longer see. So, and obviously, as Beth was mentioning, the work with refugees and with others, it expands to that, about the giftedness of this country on the principle of hospitality, and recognizing that when people are coming to this place, it's not just about us helping others, but it's about every single time someone new comes into this country, in my view, they're helping us. Because the us is expanding to just a few more. And I find that really exciting.
I want to thank both Brian and Beth for joining us this morning. Thank you very much.
Hey, that was well done.
A little theological riff on your slide.